My guest today is Stephen Drucker. Stephen is a public interest attorney who initiated a lawsuit that forced the U.S. Food and Drug Administration to divulge its files on genetically engineered food. This exposed how the agency had covered up the warnings of its own scientists about the risks, lied about the facts, and then ushered these foods onto the market in violation of federal law. Today, we're going to be talking with him about his book, which I feel is one of the most important books that I've read, called Altered Genes, Twisted Truth: How the Venture to Genetic Engineer Our Food Has Subverted Science, Corrupted Government, and Systematically Deceived the Public. Stephen, welcome to Food Integrity Now.
Thank you for having me as a guest.
I am really excited to have you speak with us today, and there's so much to talk about in this book. It's so comprehensive and so compelling. It truly is a page-turner. Let's start out with your background and what led you to embark upon filing a lawsuit against the FDA.
Well, as the introduction to the book explains, I actually did it reluctantly. I didn't really want to get involved as an activist in this issue because back in early 1996, when I began to learn the facts about this massive venture to reconfigure the genetic core of the world's food supply, I was deeply absorbed in another project. I didn't want to get sidetracked. And as I learned about some of the basic facts about genetic engineering and how it dramatically and quite drastically differs from conventional breeding and how it does entail different risks than conventional breeding, I was very concerned because of the Food and Drug Administration's, the FDA's, very lax industry-friendly policy, which was presuming all of these foods were safe. The agency was allowing all of them to come to market without a smidgen of safety testing and even without labels to inform consumers about the genetic reconfiguration that had occurred. So I thought this was quite unscientific and wrong. I also had a feeling it was illegal, and I thought there should be a lawsuit brought against the FDA, but I didn't want to be the one doing it. So I spent several weeks trying to convince the directors of other public interest organizations to take up the suit. And they were all quite excited about the idea of the lawsuit against the FDA on this issue, but none of them said that their organizations was prepared to do it. And so after essentially coming up against several dead ends, knowing that there was great enthusiasm about the suit, but that it was not going to happen, given the current state of public interest groups, of which I was aware, I was convinced by well-wishers that I should just start a public interest organization and get the lawsuit going. And if I didn't do it, it wasn't going to happen. So I founded the Alliance for Biointegrity in September of 1996. And as its executive director, began organizing the lawsuit. And since I am a lawyer, I had some background, but I knew I needed the assistance of other lawyers who understood the intricacies of federal administrative procedure law. And fortunately, I was able to attract that attention within the first few months.
And you were not a litigator. This must have been a whole new area for you to step into.
Right. I had not been actively practicing law for several years. And even during the time I was engaged in legal work, I had very little experience with litigation. I'd basically been involved in an appeal, but that's very different than working at the district court level in a suit. And especially, even had I been involved in the ordinary litigation that most attorneys are engaged with, I would have had to get up to speed in the technicalities of federal administrative procedure law.
Okay. So let's back up just a little bit here. So in May of 1992, under the GRAS standards, and for people who don't know what that means, it's generally recognized as safe. The FDA basically said that genetically engineered foods could be marketed without any safety testings, and they weren't even required to be labeled. Understanding this, what do you think led up to their decision to make that claim?
Well, as my book goes into the history of the development of genetic engineering, the growth of the genetic engineering venture, and how it expanded into agriculture with great fanfare and great hope, and also how it was necessary at every step of the way, even before genetic engineers were able to successfully reconfigure the first plant, which took years and years and was not a simple process, as they would have us believe, that there had to be deception perpetrated by the scientists who were performing genetic engineering to calm public concerns about the risks. And because there were major risks from the beginning when microorganisms were the main target, and to basically stave off federal regulation. So they learned how to be successful at this and to convince the federal government that bioengineering was something very, very important, that it had great potential on many levels, could be a great boost to the economy. And the Reagan administration was very open to such arguments because it basically had an anti-regulatory agenda anyway, and was looking for ways in which to boost the economy through the development of new technologies. So biotechnology really became the new darling in the eyes of the Reagan administration, and a coordinated framework was promulgated for the federal administrative agencies to do what they could to promote the growth of biotechnology and the introduction of its products onto domestic and foreign markets. So there were to be no new laws, and Congress did not pass any new laws, and no new regulations promulgated by the agencies either. The directive went out to deal with the products of genetic engineering through the regulations that were currently on the books. And it was felt that that would basically ease the introduction of its products. What was not fully understood at the time by at least the planners in the White House, it appears, was that there were already regulations on the FDA's books that were going to require strict safety testing of these foods. And now the FDA understood this, but they were given the directive to promote. And because they appear to have taken their promotional role far more seriously than their role to enforce the law and protect the integrity of the food supply, they ended up breaking the law.
And it's my understanding the U.S. has some pretty rigorous food safety standards. Isn't that correct?
Yes, they are. Most people are unaware of that. They assume, and rightly so, that because GMOs have permeated our grocery stores and even our convenience stores, even our health food stores, and whereas those in the European Union, you can go into a 7-Eleven in almost any European Union country, and you would be hard-pressed to find any package containing GMOs there. People naturally assume it's because the European Union has stricter food safety laws relevant to genetically engineered foods than the United States. But that's flat-out wrong. It's a false assumption. But the FDA has aided that false assumption by pretending that they're doing all they can under the law, and their hands are tied. They can't do anything more. That's malarkey. As you noted, Carol, and as the book explains in greater detail, the United States has the strictest food safety laws in the world, in regard to GMOs on the books. It's just the laws haven't been enforced. And it's important to note that the main law, which is a statute, federal statute, was passed by a Congress and signed into law in 1958. It's called the Food Additive Amendment to the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. And the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act is probably the oldest and most venerable consumer protection statute in our country. And the Food Additive Amendment was a great step forward. It placed the burden of proof on the manufacturers of any new additives coming into food that did not have a history of safe use prior to 1958. The burden of proving they were safe fell squarely on the shoulders of the manufacturer. There was a presumption that any new additive that did not have a history of safe use had to be demonstrated was, I'm sorry, a presumption that it was unsafe until proven safe. And the law clearly placed the burden of proof on the manufacturer's shoulders to demonstrate that its new additive was safe before it could be allowed in the food supply. And the FDA had promulgated, by the time of our lawsuit, it had promulgated several regulations that further clarified that statute and strengthened it. And so, again, very strong law, statutory law, and accompanying regulations that, if enforced, would have required that every genetically engineered food be carefully tested and demonstrated safe before it was allowed to be marketed. Now, if the FDA had acknowledged this, that these foods were by law presumed unsafe and had to be demonstrated safe, that would have significantly slowed up this big push to get them on the market. But there was even a deeper level of the FDA's malfeasance and ultimate deception, because its own scientists had undertaken an extensive examination of the best knowledge to date back in 1991 of genetically engineered foods. And they overwhelmingly concluded that genetically engineered foods should, from a scientific standpoint, be regarded as abnormally risky until proven safe as well. So the FDA scientists had concluded that from a scientific standpoint, the legal presumption was correct, was sound, that these foods should not be presumed safe, that they entailed a unique set of risks, that each of them should be demonstrated safe before it was allowed on the market. Now, the FDA administrators did not like hearing that input from their scientists, so they covered it up. The only reason that I know about it is because of the lawsuit, which forced the FDA to hand over more than 44,000 pages of its internal files on genetically engineered foods. So if I hadn't brought the lawsuit, I wouldn't have been sharing this information with you. We would still be completely in the dark, and we would have believed the FDA's statement in public in May of 1992, when it issued its policy on GMOs, that the agency was not aware of any information showing that foods produced through genetic engineering differ in any uniform or meaningful way from other foods. Now, of course, that's an outright lie once one understands that the FDA's files had a substantial amount of information from their own scientists explaining to them why genetically engineered foods actually should be regarded as of higher risk. So, even if they hadn't received that information, as a matter of law, they still should have required testing.
Yeah, so basically, you did not discover this information through anything like a Freedom of Information Act, but through the discovery process of the lawsuit.
Right. In fact, most people in the know in Washington and the public interest community don't think that we could have actually uncovered all this information through a Freedom of Information request that the federal agencies had been pretty good at stonewalling most requests for information about their policies on biotechnology. So it was only because the FDA was actually compelled to hand it over as a component of the lawsuit, as an aspect of the lawsuit, that we were able to get our hands on that delicate information.
You know, it just makes me wonder, because in a former life I was a legal assistant. The information that you did get through this discovery process, and it was pretty damaging to the FDA. I'm just wondering if there's more. Did they redact a lot of information, or do you feel like you got most of it?
Well, I think that we've got most of it. As I said, we were given more than 44,000 pages. There was some redaction done, but those were only on documents that had contained some what was claimed to be proprietary business information from one or another manufacturer of a genetically engineered product. So there were some blackouts so that we could not see product ingredients in some cases. But that was a very minor amount of the information, and whereas that might have been helpful to some extent, and it really was not critical. So I do feel that what they gave us contained some really damaging memos. So I think if they had tried to withhold anything, they would have clearly withheld some of those memos, and that would have been illegal. Of course, the FDA had already been breaking the law, but at least it appears that they just turned over everything and didn't try to go through and black out a lot of things that they would have preferred we hadn't seen. Let me say, I think their hope was that there was so much in there, and a lot of it, wasn't as important. They were just hoping that we wouldn't find it. And it was a big job to go through all of that and find the nuggets amid everything that wasn't as relevant.
Oh, I can imagine. That's pretty voluminous. You retained all this information, and then you went through the discovery process, and I'm sure you filed a motion for summary judgment, because this is not the type of case where there would be a trial. Walk us through what happened from there.
Well, basically, on as you mentioned, on summary judgment, all the relevant facts are supposed to be undisputed, in a light most favorable to the plaintiffs, which it turned out did not happen. We really should have had a trial, by the way. So we submitted a brief, a substantial written brief, presenting our arguments as to why, according to the law, we should win. The FDA submitted their own brief responding to ours, and then we responded to that one. And basically, there were three different briefs submitted by both us, the plaintiffs, and the FDA, the federal attorneys representing the FDA. And we expected the judge would ask for an oral argument, which would ordinarily happen in a very important and complex case like this. And surprisingly, she didn't. And in an oral argument, she can ask questions, and we can clarify things, we can emphasize points. And again, that didn't happen, which was surprising. And after a long period, the judge released an opinion in which she upheld the FDA, but in a very strange way. I have to say, it's one of the strangest, I would say even weirdest, judicial opinions that I've encountered, at least out of a federal court, which should be represent a fairly high level of competence. And the judge basically first agreed that as of May of 1998, when we filed the lawsuit, we had demonstrated there was a substantial disagreement about the safety of genetically engineered foods within the scientific community. Now, that in itself meant that they couldn't be generally recognized as safe as of that point. In essence, she tacitly conceded that as of the date we filed the lawsuit, these foods were on the market illegally. But then she did a neat trick. I don't think it neat from the standpoint of the biotech proponents, somewhat exasperating from the standpoint of those of us who were expecting justice to be followed. She said, well, that's actually irrelevant, though. The question, in essence, she said, the question is not whether these foods are on the market legally as of today. The only relevant issue for purposes of this lawsuit is whether the FDA administrators acted arbitrarily and capriciously in May of 1992 when they issued their policy presuming that genetically engineered foods are generally recognized as safe. So hopefully listeners can understand that's a very different issue. So she just focused very narrowly on whether there was some reasonable basis for making that presumption. And that was it. Just not whether the foods really were generally recognized as safe at the time, and certainly not whether they were generally recognized as safe and legally on the market as of the time we brought the lawsuit. So it was a very narrow technical issue that she was deciding on. And even then, she ignored some key evidence. In fact, there was a letter in the FDA's file from its own biotechnology coordinator to a Canadian health official acknowledging that there was not a general recognition of safety within the scientific community outside the FDA, and the FDA clearly knew that the overwhelming consensus of its own scientists was that these foods can't be presumed safe. So the FDA's own files, the incontestable evidence within the FDA's own files, showed that they knew that these foods were not generally recognized as safe as of May of 1992. But even more than that, there's another criterion mandated by the law, that even if there's a unanimous consensus about safety, which there wasn't, but even if there had been, it has to rest upon technical evidence of safety. And that should ordinarily be tests published in scientific journals. Well, the FDA's own files acknowledged that as of May of 1992, no such tests existed. So there wasn't the technical evidence available either. So, but the judge ignored all of that evidence. We pointed it out to her in our written submissions, and she didn't even address it in her opinion.
Why do you think that was? Why do you think it was ignored?
It's very difficult to try to figure out what was in the judge's mind. But I think anybody who reads that opinion could make a reasonable inference that that was a judge who did not want to be the judge, for whatever reason, that had to declare that these genetically engineered foods, which by then had permeated our supermarkets, had been consumed for several years at that point, did not want to be the judge saying, you know what? These foods really came to market through an illegal policy. And she apparently, I think the opinion and other lawyers who have read it, agree with me that she was bending over backwards, torturously so, in order to uphold the FDA, to the point of ignoring key evidence, and not even actually, she mentioned at the beginning of her opinion that there were two major criteria of GRAS for GRAS status. One, of course, was that there had to be an overwhelming consensus, but the other was that one that the consensus had to rest on technical evidence. She never even came back to that issue of technical evidence in the lawsuit, because if she had, she couldn't have ruled in favor of the FDA administrators, because there was such clear admission in their own files that they didn't have any technical evidence. Nobody did. So she completely avoided addressing that issue after initially mentioning that it was a key issue. That is astounding. I'm not aware of any other judicial opinion that begins by noting there are two key issues that need to be addressed, and then failing to address one of them and kind of dancing around so that most people weren't aware that she failed to address it.
And so, this is a federal district judge, and they're appointed by the president, correct?
Right. Yes, this is a federal judge in the District of Columbia District Court. That particular judge was a Clinton appointment. Of course, one of the odd and very frustrating things, which turns out being par for the course, is that the media did not read her opinion carefully, or didn't understand what was going on, because all they focused on was somehow FDA upheld, and often the industry spin, of course, was that these foods were on the market legally, which of course had not been determined at all. And in fact, if one reads the opinion, as I mentioned, then certainly it logically implies that these foods are on the market illegally. Mm-hmm. But nobody got that. And when I say nobody, I should say the people in the media didn't get that. Most of the public certainly wasn't given that idea. And unfortunately, as my book shows, even the law review articles didn't pay attention to what was going on. And they didn't get I haven't yet seen a fully accurate report of that opinion in a law review article, which again is astounding. So it's almost like a huge comedy of errors that has allowed these foods to continue to be on the market, despite the fact that the FDA administrators violated the law in making the presumption, the initial presumption, that they were generally recognized as safe, and continue to violate the law. And the fact is, as each year goes on, it becomes clearer that there is not a general recognition of safety about these foods in the scientific community. It's clearer now than it was in 1998, when the judge acknowledged that we had shown that there wasn't such a consensus. And within the last 8 months, hundreds of scientists have signed a statement that there is no consensus among experts about the safety of these foods, and that statement has been published in a peer-reviewed scientific journal. So, I mean, to claim, and people have to understand, today, as I speak, all of these hundreds of products on our supermarket shelves that contain GMOs, those GMOs are on the market because the sole purported legal rationale for those foods being on the market is that they are generally recognized as safe. Not that they've been proven safe, but that they are generally recognized as safe. And that, of course, claim is just, it never was true. It's been repeatedly refuted. And I mean, it's just astounding that a claim that is patently false is the sole purported legal basis for all of these foods not only being on the market today, but having been on the U.S. market for almost 20 years now. That's astounding.
Yes, it certainly is. And let's talk about the lawsuit a little bit more. You weren't the only plaintiff. You had some scientists on there as plaintiffs. Can you speak a little bit to that?
Sure. And I want to clarify, I as an individual wasn't a plaintiff at all, but it was the Alliance for Biointegrity.
Right, that's what I meant.
The nonprofit organization that I founded, the Alliance was the lead plaintiff. Then there was at least one other public interest group. And as you noted, there were several scientists, which was a very unique feature of that lawsuit. There were also religious leaders and religious organizations, and there were some eminent chefs and some other folks. So now the fact that there were 9 well-credentialed life scientists who had taken the bold step of signing on as plaintiffs to the lawsuit was unprecedented. Previously, if scientists had been involved in lawsuits against federal administrative agencies, they had been involved in the capacity of scientific advisors or expert witnesses, but they weren't plaintiffs in the lawsuit. And so it was really unprecedented that we had not just one, but nine life scientists who stated that they were not aware of any information demonstrating that a single genetically engineered food had been demonstrated, shown to be safe, let alone all of them, and that they recognized good grounds for doubting the safety of genetic engineering and that there should be proof. So, of course, as it turned out, when we got a hold of the FDA files, the FDA scientists were saying what our own scientists were saying. They were agreeing, but we didn't know that at the time we filed the lawsuit. And I have to note that some of those scientists, I mean, most of them were professors, you know, at good universities. One was a professor of molecular and cellular biology at University of California, Berkeley. Another was a professor of molecular biology State University of New York. There was a scientist who actually at Northwestern University Medical School who actually employed genetic engineering routinely in trying to cure human genetic diseases. But he understood, he told me, well, I know how powerful this technique is. I know how careful we have to be with it. And he was shocked by how reckless it was being employed in the development of new foods. And so he signed on as a plaintiff. So it was a very impressive group of plaintiffs. And that group of plaintiffs alone was basically sufficient to defeat the claim that these foods were generally recognized as safe. And that's one of the main reasons that the judge said we had demonstrated significant disagreement existed within the scientific community as of the time we filed our lawsuit.
Okay, so did you appeal it?
Yes, initially.
And what happened?
Well, what happened is we filed an appeal, and then the FDA shortly thereafter did something quite interesting. It announced it was going to bring out new regulation on genetically engineered foods. Now, it's important to note that there was no regulation specific to GMOs when we filed the lawsuit. There was only the 1992 policy statement, which was not a formal regulation. So this new regulation would have superseded the policy statement. It would have basically been the official solid FDA position. And it initially indicated it was going to do a few things that would impose some modest regulation on the industry. It's important to note that the May 1992 policy did not impose one single mandatory burden on the agency. And in fact, in our lawsuit, the FDA admitted that it was not regulating the biotech industry at all. There was absolutely zero regulation from the side of the FDA. So this new regulation, proposed regulation, although it would have been very weak and certainly not adequate, was stronger than the policy statement. Well, that would have, had it been promulgated and made an official regulation, that would have made our lawsuit essentially moot because we sued under the old policy statement. So the thought was, don't waste time on the appeal, drop the appeal, wait for the new regulation to go into effect, and then we will be, for several reasons, in even stronger position to defeat the new regulation, and we will just wait and sue against it because all the information basically that we had brought to the FDA's attention in our lawsuit that the judge said she was going to basically count as irrelevant for purposes of that lawsuit could not have been discounted for the new lawsuit. So that was sound legal strategy, but for one fact. We didn't realize that after we dropped the lawsuit and after the statute of limitations had run on it after we had dropped the lawsuit and couldn't appeal again, the FDA didn't do anything. They just let that proposed regulation sit. And 2 years later, they finally got around to addressing it again And what they said was, we don't anticipate actually doing anything, actually trying to finalize this regulation. So they basically put it on the back burner. It is still nothing more than a proposed regulation that has never gone into effect. In other words, once the FDA knew that we no longer could appeal that decision and basically were blocked from suing again, then they just fell back on the 1992 policy statement. So that is still the FDA's only policy on GMOs. It is not a formal regulation, and the FDA has admitted it does not impose one mandatory burden on the biotech industry at all. And yet in public, they try to pretend that they're doing some careful safety assessment, and it's a voluntary consultation process, which every scientist who has actually studied it says is essentially nothing. It's a rubber stamp. They don't even receive the original test data. They don't require any test data. And the FDA itself has acknowledged at least that it really is not a scientific review at all. So what we have is a situation where the FDA has admitted in court and has also admitted a few times that what's going on is not with the biotech industry is in no way regulation, that it's not regulating the biotech industry one iota, that the voluntary consultation process is not at all a scientific review. And yet, in public, most of the time, the FDA gives the impression it is regulating the industry responsibly, that it is requiring that these foods undergo scientific review, when in fact that's just smoke and mirrors. It's one of the many frauds that the FDA has been perpetrating, and here we are. In fact, most members of Congress believe that, and the media and most of the public, that the FDA is actually doing some kind of meaningful scientific review of genetically engineered foods. And that's completely false impression. But the FDA and the proponents of genetic engineering have carefully cultured that false impression.
Let's talk about the FDA and Michael Taylor and his involvement in this. He's currently the FDA food safety czar. How do you think his involvement plays into all of this?
Oh, very significantly, because Michael Taylor began his career as an FDA attorney. He served several key roles as an FDA attorney. Then he left the industry at one point and went to work for a major Washington law firm, became a partner of a major Washington law firm that represented clients in the food industry. And one of their clients was Monsanto. And he basically was involved, it appears, helping Monsanto develop the kind of policy, think through the kind of policy they would want to have, which was basically no regulation with the illusion of regulation. And then in the summer of 1991, he got brought back to the FDA as deputy commissioner in charge of policy. And of course, probably the main thing he was involved in, the main policy, was the FDA's policy on genetically engineered foods, which was in the process of being formulated. And it was while Michael Taylor was in that sensitive position that the input from the FDA scientists was consistently basically ignored and over their objections often. And a policy was crafted and issued that was super industry friendly, essentially gave Monsanto everything it wanted, zero regulation with the illusion that there was regulation. And subsequent to having done that or been in charge when that was done, Mr. Taylor was then hired directly by Monsanto to be vice president of, I think, public affairs or public relations, but certainly a vice president of Monsanto at the Monsanto Washington office. In other words, he became Monsanto's chief Washington lobbyist. So that's just an astounding example of the revolving door, even if it had stopped there. But as you mentioned, Carol, within the last few years, he's been brought back to the FDA, now with an even higher position than he had before. He's now, believe a deputy commissioner again, in charge of all food safety issues. Go figure.
And it's crazy.
And there's no outrage raised. That's outrageous. There should be. I mean, if that had happened in almost any other issue, that'd be a huge media scandal. They wouldn't let go of it. But this, you know, biotechnology gets almost a free pass in the press because the media has been so co-opted as well, which is a chapter in itself in my book.
Right. And that's a very interesting chapter. And there's so much more we could talk about, but we're pretty much out of time here. But I highly recommend that our listeners read this book because it really is so comprehensive. And it is just a fascinating history of how we've gotten to where we are right now with genetic engineering. And you might be outraged after you read this book, but hopefully it'll help people understand and maybe compel them to take some action.
Most people who read Altered Genes, Twisted Truth are rather outraged and amazed that such a massive fraud could have been perpetrated for so long.
Right. Thank you, Stephen, for being a guest on our show. Your book, Altered Genes, Twisted Truth, is a must-read for everyone. And to our audience, thanks for listening and have a great week.